welcome to Hour 2 of the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. We are spending a good bit of time on the Middle East today, and it is such a joy for me to have my guest for the next hour. Her name is Nora Barrows-Friedman. She is a producer, and she's a journalist for Pacifica Radio, KPFA, Flashpoints Radio. It's a program that I don't like to miss because they do on Flashpoints. Nora and her co-host, I'll call him co-host, Dave Bernstein, they put on the kind of material that we try to put on the Global Research News Hour. And they do it gloriously. They're veterans at it. I'm new kid on the block, and they're veterans at it. And they do such a wonderful job. Nora focuses very heavily on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She does it in California, in Berkeley, where she's based. And she makes several trips a year to the occupied territories. And she sees firsthand what's going on in the West Bank and in Gaza. It's not easy getting into Gaza these days, getting in or getting out. I don't know how she does it. I don't want her to convey any secrets during this broadcast. But, Nora, are we connected?
We are. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Oh, it is wonderful having you on. And it was glorious being in your studio in Berkeley and having a chance to meet you and meet Dennis, and that was a great treat for me.
Oh, it was great to have you as well. You got to see our chaotic, very energy-infused little office area.
Oh, it was, well, I sit in on one of your planning sessions, sort of a planning the next day's program.
Exactly. That's definitely a privilege for some and labor for others.
You do it as a full-time job.
Yeah.
With all else you do as a mother and Dennis as well.
Yeah.
And I'm an aging retiree, and somehow I fell into this by accident, and I fell into writing by accident. And now it's become an obsession, and I just can't seem to pull myself away from it, nor do I want to.
Yeah.
It really is incredible, and we certainly don't have a world of dull things going on. Never in my lifetime have I seen an array of events going on with the nation at war. You've got still the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that goes on completely under the radar, and we want to talk about it in this hour. And the U.S. economic situation just literally crumbling beneath our feet. And people come on the air and say, well, you know, we'll get this straightened out, and we've seen the worst past, and it's up and away from here. Well, I don't know about you, Nora, but I don't like to make forecasts. I'm very bad. I said that in the first hour, I think. I'm very bad on making forecasts, but I find nothing to find joy about these days, and I'm very, very worried, including the terrible conflicts in the Middle East. And one more comment, and then you jump in on Israel-Palestine. I've said this on this topic with other guests, and like you, this is a core topic for me. You see the writing that I do on it. I honestly don't believe that any peace is possible in the Middle East unless there's an equitable settlement of the Palestinian conflict, and that is nowhere in sight. You pick it up.
Yeah, I totally agree. I agree on a few issues, and I disagree on others, Stephen. I agree that there will be no regional so-called peace or justice within the Middle East until the Palestinians, and for that matter, especially the Palestinian refugees in the diaspora, are given their human rights.
Nora, can I ask you to hold that thought?
Sure.
We're going to break away for a commercial, and we'll
okay.
be right back. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Let me just mention a couple of things, Nora, then I'll let you jump right back in. Of course, this program is part of globalresearch.ca, and I try to remember to encourage listeners to go to the website, because it is indeed a treasure trove of information that's pretty tough to find in most other places. Some of the articles, you literally will not find information on other sites that cover some of what's covered there. There are wonderful sites, and you can pick up good information on lots of them. I don't know of any better than globalresearch.ca. and just take a peek at that the material has gone up in the last few days. And I think you read it or skim through it, go through it as much as you can, and you'll see why I'm going to scan everything that's on the site pretty much. One more thing, Nora. I want people to know how to find Flashpoints Radio. Very, very simple. They could go to kpfa.org, KP as in Paul, F as in Frank, A.org, click the schedule, scroll down and find Flashpoints. The schedule, the website is very easy to operate, Nora. Some sites make my eyes glaze over, but not KPFA's. And even for a computer dummy like me, it's very easy to find what I want to on the site. And they can listen live when you come on, or they can listen as I do in archive programs. This program is archived, so people can either listen live or in archives. For me, archives are easier because I'm so busy with my other activities that it's easier for me to listen when I'm doing something like eating or some miscellaneous chores that I have to take care of. That's when I do my listening. But I highly recommend Flashpoints, and it is a regular program for me to listen to. And I don't listen to much because I simply don't have time. Nora, let's go back to the Middle East. You were saying what you agreed with and what you disagreed with, and I'm curious on both.
Well, also, I just wanted to add that we do have a direct website at www.flashpoint.net, and then you can also get our archives there and more information about our daily shows. But yeah, kpfa.org is a great place to go to also listen online. So what I was saying was that I totally agree that, every single situation where we have war and occupation and displacement, dispossession, ongoing militarism and, steal of natural resources by other countries in the Middle East, all of those conflicts, it all boils down to what happened in 1948. It all boils down to the lack of justice for Palestinian refugees when they were expelled from their homeland in 1948 as Israel declared itself a state, and subsequently paved the way for Western, so-called industrialized nations to come in and create sorts of paradigms that we see right now playing out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, Israel. If someone said, someone without justice is, injustice for everyone, I'm totally bastardizing that that phrase, but if one person is occupied, we're all occupied. If the Palestinians continue to be dispossessed, continue to be maligned, continue to be occupied, that means that the entire region is therefore also on lockdown, and we are ultimately responsible for all of that as well.
I think a part of it is the U.S. Israeli militarism.
Yeah.
A connection between the two countries and how militaristic they both are, and the Middle East wars that stem from that connection. And again, it all ties into one package where you've got the terrible oppression against the Palestinian people, and you've got these two military powers, a tiny country, Israel, my goodness, a population the size of Greater Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and it's the fourth most powerful military in the world. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing,
yeah.
and it's propped up by what the U.S. supplies it
yeah.
in billions of dollars in weaponry and this terrible destructive alliance.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really it. So in that sense, yes, there's a lot of despair. It doesn't look like the situation is getting any better for Palestinians on the ground. But I think all is not lost. I think that, that the situation itself, is an untenable one. I mean, it's been getting progressively worse now for 61 years. Palestinians have been dispossessed and expelled and ethnically cleansed from their homeland. And this is ongoing, but I think we're now seeing, a bunch of people, and I'm sure James Petras brought this up as well, Zionism as an entity, is completely unsustainable. And I think we're seeing that kind of end game playing out right now, where they're trying to consolidate so much power as the world economies collapse, as, you know, industrial capitalism is kind of, you know, acting like a wounded animal right now, because it's a completely unsustainable system. I think that will eventually mean the collapse of apartheid and occupation in Palestine, Israel. I think that, I mean, you know, everyone that I speak to in Palestine say, you know, maybe it won't be this generation, maybe it won't be my children that see it, but maybe my grandchildren will be able to you know, come back to their homeland, and the wall will be dismantled, and, you know, people will be paid reparations.
Laura,
I think it's just a matter of time. But
I didn't mean to imply that I don't agree with you. I do agree with you, and Jim Petras did bring that up in the first hour, and he made the point, and some months back I quoted John Pilger making the same point, that there are things popping up around the world, people of some influence, speaking out against what's going on, and very hopefully, it's very early in the game, so, I mean, there's no groundswell, but there are signs, maybe little crocuses in the spring, where these kinds of policies absolutely are untenable, and they have to change, and they will change, and these crocuses will begin blooming, and these terrible things won't go on. They simply cannot go on forever, and they won't. What astonishes me, Nora, is after 61 years, the Israelis have just literally pummeled the Palestinians for over six decades, and they refuse to give in. They refuse to surrender. If the Israelis had their way, they would provide the transportation and escort all the Palestinians outside their borders and outside the West Bank, and I guess outside of Gaza, too. They would simply do it. Not the way the extremists want to do it, but they would be very happy to escort them out of the country. They're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
They are gaining in population. I don't know what the exact figures are, but they're pretty close to a majority population right now.
Yeah, it's almost 51%, actually.
About 51%.
Yeah. Yeah.
And despite the conflict and despite the killings and the horrors that are going on, the Palestinian population is growing faster than the Israeli population. And also, I think another hidden secret is that a lot of Israeli Jews are sick and tired of this, and they're exiting the country.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, it's not so much that they're exiting the country, although many are, but that new immigrants are not coming. So actually, I think 2006 and 2007 were the lowest rates of immigration that Israel has seen since its inception, kind of, you know, based on a per capita and you know, I'm not sure what sort of how they actually gathered those statistics, but
I believe it.
Yeah, it's true. I think people are becoming more and more disillusioned with the rhetoric of Zionism. They're watching the situation play out on the ground. They're looking at it in more of a skeptical way than I think it's ever been looked at. So those are all positive gains. That means a great deal. And subsequently Israel is having to kind of step up its propaganda and its rhetoric. We see even over here, you know, in the Bay Area, there's a bunch of very, very Zionist pro-Israel public relations machines who are working around the clock to try and dispel, you know, the so-called myths about Israel. There are, you know, all these billboards up here around Berkeley saying that, you know, Israel is the only place in the Middle East where Palestinians and Jews can play soccer together, which is, true technically if you're talking about a city in Tel Aviv, but, you know, like, they don't say anything about the actual reality in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip where Palestinians are cut off from each other, let alone the Jewish population. So, you know, but I think a lot of people, more and more people are looking past that, are actually, you know, reading the news. They're becoming more informed. Or, you know, the fact that they know that something's fishy, that this doesn't feel right.
Well, Lauren, Nobody that I'm aware of puts out more information all the time and does a better job of it than you do. I don't want to embarrass you, but it's true. Of course, the mainstream media, Israel, Palestine doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
But you're on this story all the time.
Yeah.
And if people want to know what's going on over there, and make no mistake about it, what's going on over there affects our lives over
yeah.
here. If you don't care about another country and another people, you sure care about your own self-interest, and what's going on affects us right here.
Yeah.
And if they want to know what's going on, then you give it to them on Flashpoints Radio. Your reports, the people that you bring on, reports from the ground, from people right there, and then you go over yourself and you report directly from on the ground and the people you work with. You refer to the occupied territories as your second home. Which is glorious, what you do. Oh, my goodness, have we got another break coming up? Oh, the time flies. I don't know how in the mainstream, Nora, they can give these soundbite interviews. To me, an hour is a soundbite interview.
Well, you just leave out the context and the history and put in a lot of rhetoric and you got
it. Oh, yeah. leave out the real story and you can do it. Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Nora Barrows Friedman. Oh, Nora, pick up where you left off. In the hour, let's get into a little bit into the Gaza siege as well. And you've been
yeah.
there.
Uh-huh. I was just in Palestine in June, and I was able to get into the Gaza Strip for a few days. And
I'm astonished that you could even get in. Again, I don't want to ask you how, because
thank you. Anyway, I was able to get in.
You did it, and you got out, and you got home.
Exactly. No, it's fine. I was able to go around with a really good friend of mine, Dr. Mona Al-Farah, who one of the directors of the Union of Health Work Committees in Gaza. She's also with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, and she's the director of Gaza Projects for the Middle East Children's Alliance based here in Berkeley. And she took me around to some of the hospitals that serve, the 1.5 million Palestinians inside the occupied Gaza Strip. It's per capita the most densely populated place on Earth. It's about a 22-mile by 5-mile strip of land, 1.5 million people, and basically no in or out. Since the democratic elections in June 2000, in 2007, in January, and then the subsequent siege in June of that year, 2007, the Israelis have basically cut off Palestinians inside Gaza from the rest of the world. There's a huge economic blockade. Infrastructure, no imports, exports. Fuel is very, very scarce. And I went there kind of at the height of the fuel shortage. So when I had been there before in 2005, I remember just, dodging, thousands of cars on the road. There's like basically one strip of highway that goes along the coast. And that's the way you get north to south. And before the settlers left in August of 2005, it was cut into three pieces, the entire Gaza Strip. So there was, massive hours long waits at the checkpoint, and just cars after cars after cars. So when I went in June, because of the fuel shortage, there were hardly cars on the road. I mean, the only people who had enough money to pay for fuel were, either workers for the United Nations, international NGOs, and then some taxi cab drivers, or people who had in positions in government, security services, all that kind of stuff. So it was really, really despair on the roads. And of course, it wasn't just the cars that had, people's ways of transportation that was suffering. Imagine, you know, all the ways in which fuel in this country kind of provides the lifeline of business and infrastructure. I mean, I went to some of these hospitals, and because of the fuel shortage, they were having to run on generators, and sometimes the fuel in the generators would shut off, and they were completely dark. And we're talking about hospitals with, you know, emergency rooms and operating tables and, you know, surgical procedures that couldn't be done because there was no electricity because of the fuel crisis. And I was at one of these hospitals, who was kind of, you know, surviving at the brink, you could call it, where they had generators working the day I got there. They also had a brand new intensive care wing that was literally empty. There was, there were walls and there were some chairs. There were, light fixtures, but there were no beds. There were no machines. There were no patients, and that's because the all these new operating machines and all the equipment you need in like an operating theater was on the other side of Gaza, waiting to be let in. But of course, the Israelis were not letting that equipment through. So, you know, in the hospital that I visited, Al Awda Hospital, which serves Jabalia refugee camp, which is the largest refugee camp in Palestine and across the Middle East, there are 59 refugee camps, and this is the largest one. I believe it's like 300,000 people. They didn't have any equipment for the intensive care unit of the main hospital. Also, because of the siege, I asked about medicines, because if they're not letting surgery equipment through, what else are they not letting through? Well, they weren't letting through certain medications. There's no chemotherapy or heart medication, kidney dialysis medication inside Gaza at this moment. There are hardly any emergency pain medications for women going into labor, and the number one medication that was missing from the Gaza Strip was anesthesia. So we're talking about regular anesthetic medication for surgery, for emergency services, for anything, from like setting broken bones to, epidurals. Was gone. They were not letting anesthesia through, and this struck me as just one of the most horrific and blatantly sadistic policies of the Israeli occupation government.
Sadistic, right, Nora? We need to take another break.
Sure.
But all of this, because the Palestinians had a democratic election and the wrong party won.
That's right. That's right. And where else have we seen this take place before?
Oh, I mean, it's incredible.
History.
Let's take a break and we'll come right back.
Okay.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Nora Barrows-Friedman. We're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the occupied territories, the unbelievable horrors that have gone on for over six decades. And in talking about occupied Gaza, Nora, there's no question that it's no surprise that it's known as the world's largest open-air prison.
Yeah.
It was called that before the siege. And now,
yeah,
with the siege, it's even worse. And these are terrible crimes that are being committed against this huge population. And nothing is being done. No voices are loudly being raised to condemn this.
Right.
This is just terrible stuff. Along with the medical supplies that aren't coming in,
yeah,
Israel has virtually wiped away most products that used to come in routinely. Ordinary stuff that people in civilized places can go out and buy on their own. These products are simply not allowed to come in, or what is in very restricted supplies,
right.
And then you get the basic stuff like food and electricity, and Israel can turn off, on and off the spigot at will. Months back, the Israeli Air Force bombed Gaza's only power plant, knocked it out pretty much, and am I operating at about two-thirds of capacity now? Is that right?
That sounds about right. There's just basically one power plant for 1.5 million people, and that isn't just powering homes and businesses, but it also powers, hospitals and sewage treatment facilities. So because of the lowered capacity of the only power plant in the Gaza Strip, and because of the fuel crisis, when I was there in June, a friend of mine who works for the United Nations Development Program inside Gaza, he's born and raised in Gaza, said that the sewage treatment plants were having to subvert millions of gallons of raw sewage from the treatment facility into the open ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just didn't have the power to treat all of that raw sewage because they were working at such a lowered capacity. So what does that do? That then subsequently makes the shoreline, the shallow areas, the fishing areas, very toxic because of all the raw sewage. People are swimming. It was the summer. It's still very, very warm down there. People get sick from either eating toxified poisoned fish or from drinking the water while they're swimming. They have to get treated at the hospital where there's no medication. So it's like this horrible, nightmare of a cycle. And it is collective punishment. It is a wretched policy, designed to break the will of the Palestinian spirit. But as you said, Steve, I mean, there's a certain resilience that I think the Zionists didn't estimate when they came to colonize Palestine. It didn't factor in. They thought that that the Palestinians would just scoot over and let the Zionists take over. That's not happening, and it won't happen. But the situation the Palestinians are being forced in right now is completely untenable, and it is disastrous. It is sickening, and it's happening right here. It's happening under our noses. It's happening in full view of the international community, who is not standing up and taking action against what Israel is doing.
And it's shameful that so many people, including American Jews who stand by Israel, simply don't understand the reality on the ground.
Yeah.
They just have a general concept. I'm sure members of my own family, just a general idea. I mean, I can remember many years back, I largely felt this way before I realized exactly what was going on, that you've got this small Jewish nation sitting in the middle of the Arab world. Well, number one, how did it get there in the first place?
Yeah.
The idea that this was Jewish land going back thousands of years. It's amazing the myths that are concocted to justify what people do. Who knows what the people were called way back at the beginning when these areas first began to be colonized, but they weren't Jews and they probably weren't Palestinians. They were Bedouins of some kind, and the world over going back heaven knows how many thousands of years began to be populated, and population slowly spread, and there were no demarcated borders the way they've been cut up in more modern times.
Yeah.
And for one nation to say, well, this was our land from time immemorial, and God Almighty gave it to us. I mean, what absolute chutzpah, arrogance to make statements like that. I mean, any level-headed person should think about it for a moment and say, I mean, this is pure rubbish to make a comment like that. Well, show me your bill of sale. If what you say is true, then show me your bill of sale.
Yeah, God is a real estate agent.
If God Almighty really did give this to you, then God Almighty has the power to write you a bill of sale so you can prove it.
It becomes kind of this, very convenient manifest destiny, and we see that playing out all over the place. I mean, the same rhetoric was being used to colonize this continent of course, that this was, you know, the Europeans' right. This was, you know, mandated by God. This was to be a Christian nation. We had to convert the heathens. It's basically the same story that's playing out right now in Palestine. But, you know, I think it's really easy to kind of boil it down to, you know, the religious rhetoric. I think that's been, you know, that's one of the tenets of this so-called conflict is that, you know, people just write it off, Palestinians and Jews, Muslims and Jews have been fighting for thousands of years. This is just a new incarnation of that same old struggle. And actually, that's not true. Actually, 62 years ago, in 1947, generations, hundreds, thousands of years beforehand, Muslims, Jews, Christians, all lived in that land very, very peacefully, actually. I mean, there's so many narratives right now of, you know, people who are still alive remembering that, you know, if they were, you know, Palestinian Muslim or, you know, Palestinian Jew or whatever, they all lived in similar neighborhoods. They're, you know, people would take care of each other's babies. You know, everyone learned each other's languages. It was like here, you know, some people go to synagogue, some people go to the mosque, some people go to church on Sunday. It's just like there was no division. The division, the conflict began when one group of people got the idea that they were somehow better than the other and that they were entitled to the other's land.
If you go back many decades before that, in the pre-Balfour days, the Arab population was by far the majority. Jews were a very, very tiny minority.
Yeah, they owned about maybe 1-2% of.
Maybe a few percent of the population. And
yeah.
I mean, if the Arabs wanted to walk over the Jews, I mean, they could have done it in a weekend, maybe.
Yeah.
And they lived peacefully as neighbors in the same neighborhoods, the same way we would do it here in this country today.
Absolutely.
And people don't know the history. They don't know that, and they think about these big bad Arabs.
Yeah.
Poor Israel, this little Jewish enclave
right.
in the middle of a hostile Arab sea.
Right.
Well, the only hostility there is the hostility that Israel creates.
That's right.
Jews all along could have lived in this part of the world. There was no need to create a Jewish state and separate it from the Arab state. Of course, the powers that be had a lot to do with Nora, the UN dividing up the territory and doing it in a terrible way. I mean, really just exacerbating the conflict. Go back to Balfour. I guess that was really the beginning.
Yeah.
1917, was it? Where the Brits got the idea that they wanted a non-Arab a power in the Middle East,
That's
so they
right.
guaranteed Jews a homeland. I think in the early days of Zionism, Zionists were very concerned about the persecuted Jews around the world and really wanted an oasis, I guess, where they could be free of that. But I don't think it really mattered to them much where it was. And I think the initial preference was to have it somewhere on the European continent, not in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, well, they also played around with the idea of Uganda.
As a home for
the Jews, and it becomes very people have all sorts of very personal reactions to that. I mean, you know, a third of my family were wiped out in the Nazi Holocaust, many Jews who live, you know, in Israel, historic Palestine, come from that. From that same history, and so, as a kid growing up and learning about my history, you know, kind of feeling this horrible sense of, oh my God, if I were only born, you know, 50 years earlier, maybe it would have been me. For some reason, I never got the sense that it could happen again. I mean, there, you know, that's kind of one of the rhetorics of Zionism is, well, we need a safe place for Jews and for Jews only because otherwise there will be another Holocaust. Well, you know, there won't be. There won't be. And it kind of almost, I remember as a kid feeling like because there was this, kind of a situation now being perpetrated by my so-called people, in Palestine, that kind of almost delegitimized the pain and the suffering that my family had gone through. Well, if we're just going to turn around and colonize and ethnically cleanse another indigenous people, I couldn't wrap my brain around that. And I think that's where the line of thinking stops for most people, and I think especially for American Jews, is that they get wrapped up in this, well, you know, there's no safe place for Jews except for Israel, and if we don't hold on to the tenets of Zionism, if we don't, you know, remain militant and steadfast and all of this, then there will be another Holocaust, and it's all about anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism is on the rise, and all of this. You know, actually, Israel is probably the least safe place for Jews. If you really want to get down to it, you know, in terms of people killed, of Jews killed since the beginning of the Jewish state, it actually hasn't been that safe.
Indeed, if I remember right, I reviewed Jeff Halper's newest book, An Israeli in Palestine, and I believe there was a quote in the book from his mother when he told his mother he wanted to move to Israel many years back. And his mother said to him, Israel is no place for a Jewish boy.
Why didn't people want to go back to Poland or Germany or France or Austria? I mean,
indeed.
There's that. Like, why, you know, and why does there have to be an autonomous, religiously centric place in order to feel safe? I mean, I feel safe in Berkeley, California. You know, I was like, you know, growing up with everybody. I mean, it really, you know, I feel safe because of community. It's not about, you know, some like, you know, totally, you know, I don't know what black and white situation where, you know, you're a Jew, you're a non-Jew, I feel safe just with Jews. I mean, how does that keep somebody safe?
Oh, it doesn't. The thought never crosses my mind in my dealings with people here in Chicago.
Yeah.
To stop and think, is this person or this or that or something
right.
else? It literally never crosses my mind. But even more importantly, in my case, I mean, I simply don't care. I have friends of a number of religions, and their religion is not the part of our relationship with each other. And I have a couple of glorious Muslim friends, and if someone didn't know that they were Muslim, they would have no idea. I mean,
I mean,
for people who don't think the way we do, Nora, you could say, gee, isn't it amazing? They're really no different than we are.
I mean, it's a shame. It's a real tragedy that that what has happened in Palestine, Israel, has been more to separate people and create these little enclaves of apartheid structures rather than incorporate community and intercultural celebration of that beautiful part of the world where civilization, you know, has existed for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, Jericho in the West Bank is the most continuously occupied by people, not by militarism, place on the earth. So people have lived in that little tiny part of the world ever since there were people. And so many civilizations, so many peoples, religions, beliefs, communities, languages, everything has started from that area, from Northern Africa and from what's now the Middle East and through the Levant in particular, where Palestine is. It's this beautiful part of the world where people of all shades and sizes and languages have come to be this like incredibly cosmopolitan area, and it's only been in the last 61 years that has been a point of contention rather than a point of celebration.
And really, our strength comes in our diversity.
Yes, this
one and only way is not a good way for survival.
Right.
I think another key point is I think in the situation of Israel, the issue is more imperialist than religious.
Yeah.
But Israel is a Jewish state. and Jews are the privileged people, and non-Jews, even Christians, are very much in the other category. And this is an untenable way to run a country. You simply can't do it. To have a theocratic state. I mean, the U.S. in large measure is a Christian state, or you could call it a Judeo-Christian state,
right.
But predominantly Christian, especially with a very extremist Christian right.
Right.
But, and Muslims, of course, are treated so badly in this country, especially now. But if people thought that the U.S. officially would become a Christian state, most Christians would be appalled at that idea.
That's right. Exactly. And for some reason, you know, the same Christian fundamentalists who want this to be a Christian state oppose, you know, the Islamic state of Iran. And they celebrate the Jewish state of Israel. So it's this one, it's very double standard, and it has no basis in actual reality or anything to do with multiculturalism or, you know, the geography of culture and place and language and religion.
It's never mentioned that the small Jewish population of Iran gets along just fine. They're not persecuted in Iran.
That's right.
It's a small population, but the Muslim population could walk all over them if they wanted to, but they don't. So Jews are treated okay in Iran, but Muslims in Israel, that's another story. Let's take another break and we'll finish up the hour.
Excellent.
News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Nora Barros-Friedman from Flashpoints Radio, station KPFA, Pacifica Radio. Nora, a quick comment, then I'll let you finish up. There's no question. We have no disagreement on this. The Palestinians never get a fair shake in the U.S. major media.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very sad to me right now in our major media. There are only two stories going on. One is the election. That'll be over in a few weeks. Then it'll be the post-election. And the other is the terrible financial crisis. It certainly is a major story, but grossly misreported in the major media. And they don't give people any idea what's going on. But the sad thing to me about this is that the raging Middle East, from Iraq to occupied Palestine over to Central Asia and Afghanistan, it practically doesn't exist. Thousands of people are dying every month, and it doesn't even exist.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's hard to get news from your, you know, corporate establishment media outlets when the parent companies are maintaining the occupation. You know, we talk about, you know, why doesn't NBC cover what's happening in Palestine or Iraq or Afghanistan? It's because NBC is owned by General Electric, which makes all sorts of communication systems and electronics for the U.S. military. So, of course, they're going to have kind of a conflict of interest. I don't think they would, it's not in their best interest to cover what should be covered.
And what they don't make, they have advertisers who do make it.
Exactly. It's a very interesting relationship. And I think that, you know, I think we have to call it out like it is. You know, we really need to take responsibility for our own media making. I think that's something that we do here on Flashpoints. I know you do, Steve. You know, if you're outraged about something, you know, don't slink into a corner. Go out and do something about it. I mean, I got into radio as a kid. You know, I took the youth radio training course here in Berkeley with KPFA and KPFB. My parents actually met here at KPFA in the 60s. That's how they met each other. They were both programmers. So I kind of came back full circle. But what really got me into radio this time around was I was, you know, at home. My daughter had just been born. It was right after 9/11, and I was sitting there with my little baby, and I said, I cannot just work, a retail job anymore. I can't do something that's not going to impact people or impact my own life. And I was sick of really hearing the rhetoric that was being played out in the establishment media. I just couldn't, you know, all we had was, you know, KPFA and then, you know, cable television. And I just found myself, you know, literally like throwing stuff at the television, in those months after, and I know you did. And so I said, well, I have this training background, it'd been a few years, but still. I said, why don't I just go, see what I can do at KPFA. And I went in there and I met Dennis and I said, hey, look, I have this training as, a youth radio graduate. And he said, great, when can you start? and that's literally what happened.
I had no idea.
So, it just takes being confident and really, taking matters into your own hands. I mean, there's a lack of reporting on Palestine. Oh my God, yeah, of course. Well, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to just like yell and scream about it and slink into a corner? No, or are you going to actually, start reporting?
And you do it even taking flack, you do it, and other stories that you cover on Flashpoints, you do it even when you take flack because it's important to do.
Yeah.
We have to do it, and I hear that music in the background. They're going to cut us off in a moment. let me just say thanks for coming on. It was a glorious, but all too rapid hour. All the hours are too fast.
Definitely.
I mean, we could keep this going all afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
But you got a program to put together later in the afternoon.
I sure do. Speaking of which.
and I'll be listening. If not live, I will listen in archives. But again, Nora, my great thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Steve. Anytime.
Oh, thanks. We got to do it again, and we will.
Definitely.
Thanks, Nora.
Thank you.